It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll get a preview of next month's issue of Discover Magazine, which hits shelves tomorrow. We'll tackle the top science news from the issue, including a cancer infecting Tasmanian devil populations and a sci-fi summer movie preview.
First, Wisconsin wildlife officials want to give the state's invasive species list its first ever overhaul. The changes would relax restrictions on the emerald ash borer, but toughen standards for other plants and animals on the list.
Terrell Hyde is with us. She's a conservation biologist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Terrell, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks.
Well, let's start out by taking a look at what might change now in regards to invasive species. What's changed?
Well, the invasive species rule, which is Wisconsin's chapter NR40, which was first put into place in 2004, is receiving its first revision since its creation. So we're adding new species to their two regulated categories in the rule, and we're improving language to help with compliance and updating scientific names of species.
Now, to get a sort of 101 on invasive species, what is the definition of that?
Well, as defined in Wisconsin statutes, invasive species are non-indigenous species whose introduction causes or is likely to cause economic or environmental harm or harm to human health.
And why is it so important that we keep track of these plants and animals that could cause harm?
Because, like in the definition, they have the ability to cause great economic or environmental harm to species that were listed in the original rule, zebra mussels, we have in the state, and there has been significant economic hardship to Wisconsinites.
And why do wildlife officials want to change the list? What's changed that now is the right time to shift things up a bit?
Well, in 2004, when the original list was created, we listed species whose invasiveness was significant or species that were in the region but not quite in Wisconsin, and they were not they would not have any impact to regulated industries. And it was understood at that point that there would be a revision in the future to look at species that we already have in, say, the nursery industry, where we would need to involve those impacted entities to a greater degree.
Now, one change that seems significant regards the emerald ash borer. That used to be something, if people found it, they had to destroy it. What is the new policy?
Okay, well, in the invasive species rule, we identify and classify invasive species into two different categories. There is a prohibited category, which those species are species that aren't in the state or don't have established populations. They have high potential for environmental impacts, and it's still feasible to eradicate and prevent their spread in the state. Examples are kudzu, feral hogs. Restricted species is the other regulated category, and those species are species that are already in the state. They have high environmental impacts, but their complete eradication is unlikely. So the emerald ash borer in 2004, when it was listed as a prohibited species. That species has now spread to 19 counties. So it no longer meets the definition of prohibited. So it's just a reclassification of the species into the restricted category. We're now looking at not eradicating this, but trying to slow and prevent its spread to other parts in the state.
So does that kind of mean we've lost the battle with the emerald ash borer and we have to sort of re-strategize?
I think there's a recognition that it's here. And so we need to put our efforts in not trying to eradicate it, but trying to control it.
Well, what are some of the other proposed changes here?
Well, there are 84 new species that are being added to the list. Some of these species people might recognize, nutria. While we don't have them in the state, they are listed federally in neighboring states.
They look like muskrats.
They do. They
right?
do.
Are they water-dwelling rodents just
they
like muskrats?
They are. They burrow under and through water control structures like levees and dikes, and they could cause significant damage, causing flooding.
I see. So muskrats don't do that, but nutria do. And I understand there are also some shrubs that are commonly sold in a lot of nurseries that may be showing up on this list.
Yeah. So through this development, this is a very long process. In 2012, the Wisconsin Council on Invasive Species charged the department with starting this process, and they convened species assessment groups to look at over 200 species and recommend them to different, if they fit the two regulated categories. And so we've taken that through the rule process, where 84 species are initially being recommended to one of those two categories. And at this step in the rulemaking process, we are preparing to go out for public hearing. So we're still very early in the rulemaking process. And we're adding new species. We're improving clarification. One of the species assessment groups looked at those shrub species, and there are two species that come to mind as being prevalent in the nursery industry, and that's Japanese barberry and burning bush. And through the process, many people have those plants in their backyards, and through that process, in involving the stakeholders, the regulated industry, that it was recognized that there are certain cultivars of those two species that aren't as invasive, whether they don't spread vegetatively or they don't produce as much seed. And therefore, in proposing to list those two species, the department, the Wisconsin Invasive Species Council, the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, has listed specific cultivar exemptions.
Okay, so that could temper that a little bit. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that a hearing is in the works. Is the next step after that, once you've got everything finalized, to get the public on board and educate them about what the new things are on the list and what to look out for?
I think public education has always been a part of this. The Wisconsin Invasive Species Council is composed of people in the regulated industry, businesses, individuals, and through that process, species assessment groups, which are composed of non-agency folks, as well as agency folks, looked at each of these species recommended. Last spring, there were public hearing sessions on that initial recommended list before we even proposed them through the rulemaking process. There have been lots of mailings, and I think the importance of that is that it's engaging and educating and informing people on slowing the spread of these invasive species is a good thing. And yes, we have public hearings that are coming up, and there are many steps along the way for people to provide input and let us know how they'll be impacted.
Well, Terrell, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Veronica.
That was Terrell Hyde, conservation biologist with the Wisconsin DNR. She was with us to talk about proposed changes to Wisconsin's invasive species list.
Tomorrow, another issue of Discover Magazine hits shelves. We have one of the editors here to give us a sneak peek at some of the most interesting stories in the upcoming issue.
Gemma Tarlak is a senior associate editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Gemma, welcome back.
Hi, great to be with you again.
Well, let's start by talking about something that's getting pressed for a while, the story of the Tasmanian devil cancer, which has been kind of baffling scientists and decimating the devil population in Tasmania for a long time. Catch us up. What's happening there?
Well, it's been a tragic just about 14 years since they've been studying it, and the cancer's been around, as far as we know, for about 20 years. I have to preface this by saying I have a thing for Tasmanian devils.
They're adorable.
I adore them.
Yeah, I was surprised. I mean, that the cancer is incredibly disfiguring, but the animals are really cute.
And they're sweet. You know, I actually spent several weeks in Tasmania a few years ago and got to go to all the sanctuaries where they're trying to create this sort of reserve insurance population in case all the wild ones are wiped out. And they're just the sweetest, most timid, you know, they're like a frightened little dog, like a little Boston Terrier, and they just make funny noises sometimes. But anyway, so this cancer has been baffling them because it is a contagious cancer, and that is extremely rare. There's only one other known contagious cancer, and that infects dogs. But they couldn't figure out how exactly this cancer was moving so rapidly from one devil to another. And they finally settled upon the fact that the proteins on the cell. You know, when you think about a cell, it's kind of got all these proteins on top that tells other cells in the neighborhood basically what it is. And sometimes those proteins tell your immune system, hey, this shouldn't be here, and your immune system fights it off. Well, these particular cells in this Tasmanian devil cancer, they hide some of their proteins. And it's kind of a remarkable science going into it, way, way too detailed to sum up here in a couple minutes. But they figured out that it's hiding the proteins, so the cell enters the new victim's bloodstream, enters their body, and it's not recognized as being foreign. The body treats it as its own, as one of its own cells. So it's very scary, but at the same time, the fact that they're making strides in this research means that they may be able to save the devils and sort it out and advance cancer research, too, at the same time.
Well, now that they've figured it out, it's a stealth cell, in effect.
Yeah.
Is that pointing toward the kind of research they need to do to try to stop it?
You know, what they're trying to do is figure out a way that the cancer and the devil can coexist, because they looked at something like a vaccination program, and that's just not feasible, because they would have to go into the wild and find these very reclusive animals and not only vaccinate them, but then vaccinate their offspring, because the offspring wouldn't inherit the immunity. So they're trying to find ways to help the cancer evolve more quickly. It may sound counterintuitive, like, why do we want to help the cancer? But right now, the cancer is too deadly for its own good. You know, ideally, this is kind of a parasitic cancer, to use the term parasite loosely, but it's basically feeding off the animals as it infects each one. And they're trying to figure out a way to make the cancer less deadly, which would make the cancer more likely to survive, because the animal it's infecting are going to live longer. But at the same time, those animals are going to live longer. So they're trying to, I guess, broker a peace deal is one way of putting it, between the devils and this contagious cancer.
Now, you said the cancer has been around about 20 years, and there's some optimism now about understanding the cancer better. But can you tell us a little bit about what the population has done over those past 20 years?
Oh, my gosh. In some areas, the population has fallen by 90%. Other areas, they're doing a little bit better. About only 30 to 45% of the population has been lost, but the cancer is still spreading. So, you know, I can remember even when I was there in 2011, the researchers I talked to were very sort of pessimistic and thinking that creating these insurance populations on in sanctuaries and also on remote islands might be the only way to save the devils. But now they're actually more optimistic, and they're thinking, we saw the rates really dropping, but we think they may have bottomed out, because the devils that have not been infected may actually be, you know, have a kind of resistance to the cancer. And that it's not just that they haven't come in contact with the cancer. Maybe they've already come in contact with it, but maybe it has not infected them.
And this is a region of the world where we've lost a lot of mammal species in recorded history, right?
Yeah. Australia, I believe, leads the world in the dubious honor of having the most mammal extinctions known. And Tasmania is a special case. It's a little island off the south coast of Australia. And it's, in a lot of ways, kind of an ark, if you want to think of it, for other species that have gone extinct on the Australian mainland. And part of it, it's very secluded. There's a really nasty stretch of water between the mainland and Tasmania that makes it difficult for a lot of kind of cross-species populations. But they're surviving, and the Tasmanian devils, which were once on the Australian mainland, went extinct there 5,000 years ago, and their last toehold in the world is on Tasmania. So.
Well, it's encouraging to know that there might be some bright light at the end of the tunnel as they move forward with that.
Yeah, and you know, just the fact that all of the researchers are optimistic gives me hope, because, you know, usually you get a mix like, oh, I don't know if this is going to work, but they're all saying, yeah, we think we're narrowing down how to deal with this.
Well, another one of this month's features is about Hurricane Sandy. Tell us about that story.
This is a really interesting story for me personally, because I actually grew up in the New York City area. And, you know, I know how populated it is. I've seen flooding even when there wasn't a hurricane, just after a heavy rain. And the author's argument is basically, Hurricane Sandy was a bad storm, yes, but the destruction it caused was pretty much a man-made disaster. And his theory, or his argument, is that New York City, greater metro area, is built on a floodplain. They've been filling in land, reclaiming it from the sea for centuries, you know, for 300 years. And when we ran the story, our photo editor did a great thing where he found a map and lined it up exactly with Google Earth maps. And you can see in lower Manhattan just the enormous chunks of land that have been reclaimed from the sea. And these were all the areas that were hardest hit when Hurricane Sandy came through. So it's kind of a provocative argument, but he really backs it up with a lot of history.
This is after Sandy. Were people talking about this before Sandy, saying, hey, we're putting ourselves at risk of flooding based on where and how we're building?
Yes, you know, this has been an ongoing conversation in the New York area, but it was really interesting, and he gets into this a little bit, that after Hurricane Sandy, you know, you had New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, Mayor at the time Michael Bloomberg, President Obama, everyone saying, oh, you know, nature, she's so awful, this is the force of Mother Nature, oh, this was a major assault by Mother Nature. Nobody reacting to Hurricane Sandy really said, well, we kind of saw this one coming. And the thing is, we still haven't learned from it. You know, Ted Steinberg, the author, mentions they're still planning on building, for example, a 26-acre real estate development. It's going to be built right in the middle of a floodplain. So that, you know, what we learn from history is that we don't learn from it, you know?
Well, do you think that there is hope on the horizon that the argument and acknowledgement that this is a floodplain could lead in the future to different building practices, especially as maybe the East Coast starts to see more severe weather?
Right, and that's actually something else that Ted gets into in the story, that we are in just a natural cycle. Set aside climate change and all the things climate change is going to do, but we're just in a natural cycle of the warming ocean, so we can expect more and more intense storms. Plus, with climate change, we've got, you know, the ocean levels are rising, et cetera. One would hope that this would kind of sound the warning call, but it's very unclear. And in fact, the only thing that gives me hope, and I never thought I would say this, Donald Trump decided not to go forward with one of his many real estate projects because of concerns that it would get washed away in another Hurricane Sandy. Hmm. So there's a little bit of hope there.
Well, and finally, you have a little fun in this issue, previewing the summer's top science fiction movies. And speaking of nature exposing the folly of men, here's a clip of one coming out.
In 1954, we awakened something.
There's nuclear tests in the Pacific. Not tests.
They were trying to kill it.
It being Godzilla. And in this issue, you've got a flowchart to help us decide what summer sci-fi movies to see. We've got that on the Central Time Facebook page, along with a Tasmanian Devil video, by the way. How did you design this summer sci-fi flowchart?
Well, you know, there's so many of these big movies that when you watch the trailers, which is really all that's available right now, they all have the epic music and the darkly shaded characters and all the, you know, lingo, like, in a world, torn apart. Yeah, you know, and so just because of the sameness of a lot of the trailers and a lot of the pitches and buildup that you get from the studios, we decided to just have some fun and let people know what's coming out and when it's coming out, but have some fun with what you might like. So, for example, as we go through the flow chart, one of the questions is, do you hate Tom Cruise? Yes, no. You know,
or do you like Men in Tights? Yeah.
Yeah. Everyone has an answer to that question, right?
What about Tom Cruise in tights?
Hmm. Ooh, that's just a mental image that's going to be, ooh.
Sorry about that.
Ooh. All right.
Yeah. Well, tell us
down and recover.
Sorry, Jem, I took you out of action. Well, tell us about some of the movies you are excited about based on your flow chart. What looks good?
Well, thanks. And I am a hardcore Godzilla fan. I love it. Loved it since I was 3 years old. And my grandpa would take me to, like, Saturday matinees that would run those chopped up American versions of the Japanese original. So I love Godzilla. The trailers I've seen for this one, it looks like they finally did justice to him. You know, it's not going to be the 1998 mess with Matthew Broderick. So I'm really excited about Godzilla. And I actually interviewed Matt Reeves, who is the director for Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, for another story I'm doing. And we chatted a little bit about both the computer-generated effects in the movie and also his approach to depicting an ape civilization. And, you know, I wasn't, quite frankly, really interested in seeing the movie until I talked to him. And it sounds like he did a lot of really interesting things to create this feasible ape civilization.
Well, Gemma, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us again.
My pleasure, always.
In a world full of confusing science information, Gemma Tarlak helps us make sense of it all. She's Senior Associate Director at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She joins us each month at about this time.
And don't forget, you can find the flowchart, which will help you figure out what summer movies you'd like to see, on our Facebook page, along with some videos of the very charismatic Tasmanian devils that Gemma Tarlak was talking about.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, a new report shows that more than half of all Americans who fought in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan struggle with mental or physical problems stemming from their service.
First, a lot of popular TV shows are showing a definite willingness to kill off significant characters. HBO's Game of Thrones, that's the theme song there, it debuted its fourth season last night. That show has led this homicidal trend. And others, from Downton Abbey to The Good Wife, have had some shocking deaths of their own.
In the age of DVDs, live streaming, and binge-watching, what's the etiquette for talking about character deaths and other plot twists when we're all watching at a different pace? The show Portlandia tackled spoiler etiquette in this clip.
We watched Breaking Bad last night.
Oh, my God, no spoilers. No, no, we haven't watched it yet. We T-voted it.
We just finished the first season.
That's the best television I've ever seen. The way they do it? And Gus?
No, we haven't seen it.
Spoiler alert. Stop. What?
That's not a giveaway.
We'll talk about it behind your
back. Season one, first of all, you're like, what kind of a show is it? Season two?
Stop.
Hold on a second.
Stop.
I'm not saying anything. All I'm saying, wasn't it cool the way it went down?
So are you guys watching Game of Thrones?
Who isn't?
So who's king? Is it Joffrey?
It just started.
So good.
Are you guys watching Mad Men season?
No,
stop.
Dawn with Meghan or
Ben. I had no idea.
Are you guys thinking of the new season of Dexter?
Michael C. Hall in the van?
Spoiler alert.
Don't spoil it.
Why do shows kill off characters, and how do we talk about it without spoilers? Christopher John Farley joins us now. He's editor for the Wall Street Journal's Life and Culture blog. He's author of the book Game World. Christopher, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Let's start with the killing. Why do shows kill off important, significant characters?
Well, I think part of the reason why it's happening is to compete with cable. You know, cable's able to have more surprises, bloody deaths, nudity, all kinds of crazy things. And so we're seeing more network shows like Person of Interest, like The Good Wife, also show we can play that game, we can kill off our characters, because there's a whole battle going on between TV that's real, that has artistic aspirations, and TV that's just comfort food, where you see the same characters come back week after week, and they go through adventures, and nothing really ever happens to them. They never really get hurt in any kind of significant way, because you want to bring them back year after year, because they're just a gravy train for the network. And cable shows are mostly structured differently than that, where characters die, they don't come back, maybe it's only a limited-run series, and those shows seem to have a much greater hold over the public imagination, because they have the capacity to surprise, the capacity to shock, and network shows, they want in on that.
And you think that's what viewers want? Viewers want a body count as long as it comes along with drama and surprise and all that other good stuff?
They do and they don't. The viewers don't even know what they really want. And it also sometimes differs from show to show. For instance, with A Good Wife, I'm going to issue a blanket spoiler alert over everything that I say in this
show
today,
okay,
so no one can be shocked. But, of course, they killed off a major character, Will Gardner, played by actor Josh Charles. He's a beloved character, had a great interplay with the other characters, was really a central driver to the whole show. And so when he was killed off suddenly, without any kind of advance warning, people were upset. Because even though it spoke to the quality of The Good Wife, they were willing to take a chance like that on a major character. People love that character. They come back to The Good Wife week after week for quality television. And now this major pillar in their life was pulled away. And the producers issued the statement saying, oh, this is like real life. We have losses in real life. Well, that may be true. We have lots of losses in real life, which is why we're watching TV. We want to get away from all that and have a little bit of fun.
Was it? Is it a matter of following rules that you establish in Game of Thrones? Okay, they set out pretty quickly. People are going to die. The Wire, The Sopranos, you know, they're mobsters. They're going to die. In a regular network drama, if I'm watching it, hey, that's breaking the rules if you start killing people off like that.
You're right. There are some rules that TV shows seem to follow, but even those rules, the audience doesn't always seem to quite understand them. The other day, we had one of the stars of Game of Thrones hanging out at the Wall Street Journal talking to some fans, John Bradley. He plays Samwell, and he was talking about spoilers in other shows. He was talking about The Wire and a major character that gets killed there, and one of the fans we had there sort of gasped because he couldn't believe that character got killed. He was really upset that John Bradley was revealing this death that had happened like 4 or 5, maybe 10 years ago, whenever The Wire was last on. He was still upset that John Bradley had spoiled it for him. So for some people, the spoiler alert extends in perpetuity forever. And, of course, we can't really live our TV lives that way.
Well, don't you think sometimes you're doing people a kindness by spoiling it for them? For instance, I wish that Rob had told me what happened in a certain scene in Game of Thrones in which nearly everyone dies.
Before you read it on Mother's Day?
Before I read it on Mother's Day. To me, that would have been kind.
Well, we both want to know and we don't want to know. I mean, because once someone tells us a surprise, you can't never get that back. And that you've taken away a bit of great TV art when that happens. You know, whether it's TV or the movies, I mean, do you really want to know that, you know, Gandalf gets killed and comes back, or that Dumbledore gets killed and doesn't come back, or Obi-Wan Kenobi gets killed and...
Oh, you're killing us here, man.
We don't know any of that stuff. We just don't want to know that stuff because the art surprises us. It's what makes it worth watching. And part of the test of great art, I think, great TV art, is when we get killed. If they get killed and we don't care, something's wrong with that show.
Let's follow the spoiler track a little bit. I want to play a clip from one of the big mysteries of an earlier TV era, before the TiVo and DVDs and things like that, Twin Peaks. Here's a little clip from very early on in the show.
Morning, Pete. Harry.
She's dead. Wrapped in plastic.
Hold on a second, Pete. Where? You stay right there. I'm on my way.
She was Laura Palmer. That scene started people asking the question, who killed Laura Palmer? Back then, everybody who was watching found out at the same time. No DVDs, no web streaming, no spoiling. How much has the way we talk about TV changed since that era?
Well, first, a few words about Twin Peaks. The reason that show worked early on is because it had established that we're in this kind of, you know, regular kind of town with just a bit of weird undercurrent there. But then when it got far out weird, where anything could happen, it no longer had the capacity to surprise because any weird thing could happen. There could be robots, could be aliens. We just didn't know. We didn't care. But when it was just like an ordinary town like anyone could live in with just a few weird things going on, then the weird deaths, the quirkiness, that surprised us. What's different today about the way we talk about TV is that we're all living in different time zones. For a while, back in the day, there were only really pretty much two time zones, what you saw in New York and what you saw in L.A. And so you wait a couple hours, everybody knows. Now people are binging at a different pace, binging in their own time. Years later, maybe they got a screener in before. And so it's hard to know what you can talk about and not talk about without spoiling an entire series for somebody.
Do you think we'll hit a saturation point eventually where we're just desensitized when TV characters die off? It's just what shows do to pull the rug out from under the viewer.
Well, the good shows, I think, will continue to surprise and shock us and interest us when they pull the rug out and kill a character suddenly, like what happened early on in Game of Thrones with Ned Stark. But the shows that perhaps have a little less integrity, that maybe kill someone and bring them back and break the rules, now, that won't interest us as much. For instance, Family Guy. You know, they killed off Brian the dog, which was very controversial. At first, it seemed like kind of a brave move. Then they brought Brian the dog back, and it became a huge cheat, I thought. I thought it undercut the quality of the show, that they would take this bold move and pull it back and excuse it. Why watch a show that's gonna cheat its viewers in that way?
Well, another approach to death on shows are, I remember shows with very non-consequential deaths, and I'm thinking mainly of especially the earliest edition of Star Trek with the famous red shirts. If there was somebody down with Kirk You didn't know their name.
Yeoman Blank.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They were going to buy it, probably. So I mean, is that how cheap is that as far as a dramatic standard?
Yeah, you don't want to beam down with Captain Kirk. If you're in that beaming down party and you don't really have a name in the script, it's not going to be a good day for you. You're not going to be coming back. That's always tough. That did sort of set the standard for expendable deaths. But, you know, there's been some major deaths recently. Person of Interest, one of the three major characters, you know, Detective Joss Carter, played by Taraji P. Henson, terrific actress, someone who, you know, people have seen in the Academy Award shows, and her character got killed off, and that really shocked fans of the show. And it may be a fatal shock, too, because she was pretty much the only reason I watched that show, and I'm not going to go back to it now that she's dead. If they bring her back, that cheats the rule so completely, I wouldn't watch it again. Homeland, for example, a lot of people watch that show because of Damian Lewis and Nicholas Brody. As we know, he got hung. So very realistic, very cool they did it. I don't know if I want to watch it again now that he's gone. And maybe my wife doesn't want to watch it either. So you're really playing with fire when you're trying to prove how cool and hip and cutting edge and real your show is by killing off a main character that lots of people really love.
We're talking to author and pop culture writer Christopher John Farley about TV shows that kill off their own characters, oftentimes major characters, and how to talk about shocking plot twists when not everyone is watching at the same pace. And in case you haven't figured, if there's any TV show that you've ever heard about but wanted to watch, you might not want to listen now because we're telling you lots of blanket spoilers. Yeah. Yep.
Well, you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Is there a show that you love or maybe past tense loved that shocked you with the death of an important character? Does that raise your emotional connection to the show, raise the emotional stakes, or does it turn you away from it? And do you have a hard time talking about TV, especially major plot twists like a character death, with that spoiler issue in mind? Does it put the kibosh on talking about shows with people you know? Call in at 800-642-1234.
We continue our conversation about TV shows killing off characters, the trend to have a major character who's beloved by the masses and thereby kill him as quickly or her as possible seems to be the trend right now.
And also how to talk about spoilers and plot twists with people who are watching at different speeds and different ways than we are. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there a show, past or present, that shocked you when it killed off a character? Maybe a character you liked. Is it hard to talk about TV shows these days without spoiling things? And have you had something spoiled for you? Maybe in this show. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. We'll go straight to our callers. We've got Frank with us in Onalaska. Frank, hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. The show I'm going to pick on is the Fox cult murder show, The Following, where they not only killed off Joe Carroll, the cult mass murderer, as the antagonist, but they killed off the love interest, his wife, who was the love interest for the protagonist, Kevin Bacon, as well.
Did they lose you at that point, Frank?
Well, you know, it's just, you know, weird enough that, you know, first they made the murders in kind of a poll-like author, imitator, and then they keep on bringing in, you know, these more murderers. The thing that bothers me the most, though, is besides the gruesomeness of the killings, which is a little disturbing, is the fact that they keep on bringing in FBI agents and sheriff's deputies who turn out to be also cult killers just to move the plot or keep things working weird. So I got to say, it's just cheap writing in that regard.
Gotcha. Frank, thanks for the call. So, Christopher, it sounds like he thinks they didn't earn it. They didn't earn killing off those characters dramatically.
Yeah, and the thing is again, it's a litmus test of how good your show is if people care so deeply about the character they're truly disturbed by it. And often they'll stick with the show because they think, okay, this is a show that I really love. It's also a test of whether or not you have enough good characters to continue keeping people's interest even after that main character is killed off. I mean, a show like House of Cards, they killed off a main character, but she wasn't the only game in town. Kevin Spacey's still on that show, and so people keep watching it. They're still interested in it, even though they killed off a main character. MASH, of course, famously killed off a character, you know, Henry Blake in 1975, had a huge impact, but Henry Blake wasn't the central character on that show. There are other characters we probably cared about more and who made the show funnier. And so even though it was a heart-wrenching moment, you still kept watching. So it's a balancing act that shows have to pull off, but it's a huge, huge risk when you kill off a character that people really feel a deep attachment to, and they're so attached to it they don't want to be attached to your show anymore once that attachment is cut.
Right, and if you look at Game of Thrones, speaking of a giant cast list, there's about 5,000 characters in Game of Thrones, so that could keep going indefinitely. But maybe other shows are running a riskier gamut if their cast list isn't as thick.
Yeah, but there are a couple of characters in Game of Thrones. I think that it would be tough for them to kill off. You know, one, because they don't die in the books yet, and two, because, for instance, they killed off the Mother of Dragons. I think there's probably a lot of fanboys who would probably cancel the subscriptions to HBO. I think they just pull the plug right there.
I hope George R. R. Martin isn't listening.
Yeah.
Challenge accepted.
Do not dare him. Yeah. Let's go back to our callers. We've got Dana on the line in Onalaska. Hi, Dana.
Hi. How are you guys?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, my comment is actually also about the Game of Thrones. I read all of the books in A Song of Ice and Fire, which is the series that show is based off of. And the spoiler for me, having not seen the show, was the fact that everyone made such a big deal about the Red Wedding, because I felt that Robb Stark in the book was not nearly as central of a character as apparently he is on the show.
That was, I don't know, that's a scene that Veronica mentioned being shocked by in the book. There are some famous videos floating around of people reacting to watching that for the first time, people who hadn't seen the show. That was, I don't want to give it away to too many people, Christopher, but that was a big shocker for a lot of people.
It was the body count, the
well,
huge amount
too.
Of carnage.
And who
yeah.
and how, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it was shocking, but what's great about the series of Game of Thrones right now is that nobody knows how it's going to end. I mean, because it's not done yet. I mean, I was at the premiere with George R. R. Martin, and the guy is still writing the books. He has not finished book 6, The Winds of Winter, though he's made some headway. He's spending some time doing other things, like writing a script for the show. And so there's still that possibility that everyone could get killed, or no one could get killed. We just don't know where it's going. And the fact that nobody knows, and not even the author has finished it yet, he reportedly has told HBO where the whole thing is going, just so if anything happens to him, God forbid, they could still finish the series. But still, we're on this journey with George R. R. Martin and the producers of Game of Thrones, because it has not yet been concluded yet.
All right, thanks, Dana. And let's go next to Alex. Alex joins us from Stoughton. Hi, Alex.
Hi there. The first thing I want to say, and it's on the topic of binge watching, is the show I want to talk about, 24, starring Kiefer Sutherland from Fox. That was a show that I think is very conducive to binge watching, because as soon as you're done with 1 hour of the show, as it's done incrementally in like 24 episodes in a season, 1 hour for each show, very, very easy to binge watch through those. And also wanted to mention how they would pretty consistently build up other protagonists that weren't the main protagonist, Jack Bauer, and then kill them off in a way that was both unexpected but didn't make me lose interest in the show. Because while I did mourn them, I more mourned that in the place of Jack Bauer, and because of their relationship, but still kept things centered on the main character. So yeah. Very impressive work.
All right, thanks, Alex. And what about that, Christopher? Is that a show that gets it done right?
It certainly is, especially early on in 24. I think it really did a great job of keeping the viewer's attention and killing off the right characters, but not killing off the ones we really cared about and would take us through the show. But you know, the thing about binge watching is because of this tendency to kill characters off, we're almost in a race sometimes to finish off these new seasons before everyone at the office tells us who gets killed off. I mean, I remember when Orange is the New Black gets released, everyone is racing through it just to make sure no one at work tells them what's happening. The new House of Cards, of course, when that came out, everyone was racing through it so no one would tell them what happened at work, or they wouldn't read something on Twitter. So that's this kind of forced binge watching, just so people don't spoil it for you. That's kind of a problem, because you might want to watch some of these shows and let them play out over time, because they're such quality shows. It might be more fun to watch them over the course of a month or 2 months. Like, TV was meant to be watched.
I have to say, I don't mind spoilers. I know Robb, I think, hates them, but I don't mind them at all. I don't think it diminishes my enjoyment.
Well, I've seen studies, I mentioned actually during the break to Veronica, some studies that people may actually appreciate things more after having them spoiled. Even though they won't admit it, their enjoyment factor, however that's measured, is increased with that, I guess, anticipation.
Yeah, so maybe we just need to lighten up about spoilers.
You know, I think the greatest enjoyment is actually watching other people enjoy the shocking scenes that you already know are coming. We all saw those videos that were all over the internet of people watching the Red Wedding and their shock when they saw it happen. And I actually had more fun watching those videos than actually watching the Red Wedding. It was so cool to see the surprise and the shock and people not believing this was actually happening. That was cool to watch because I think it signaled to you again that art has a capacity to surprise, that TV can still do some things. It's not just, you know, this boob tube. It's something more than that when done right. And just seeing that played out with the Red Wedding scene, that was nice to watch.
I was trying to pull some clips of those people reacting. I couldn't. There weren't enough stretches without profanity that I could actually play them on the radio. Yeah, that was an amazing thing to watch, though. Comment from Kirsten on Facebook. She says 6 Feet Under was a great show where they killed off the main characters one by one.
Yeah, 6 Feet Under, again, another cable show. And I think it's one of those shows the networks are trying to compete against because the show that had some surprising deaths, had some surprising twists and turns, had a hold on reality that was perhaps greater than a lot of things you see in the comfort food like TV shows that are mostly on the networks. And it helped lead us to where we are today, where we're seeing more of this kind of sudden death television where characters are expendable just like they are in real life.
So, Christopher, how do you handle it? You know, you write about TV and you watch a lot of it, obviously. Do you hold your tongue around people or do you just let it rip in terms of letting the spoilers go?
Well, there are two ways to handle it. One, as a writer myself, when I wrote my book Game World in it, but, you know, you want them to earn their deaths. You want people to sort of become attached to them before you kill them. There's no reason to kill off a character that no one's going to feel an emotional connection to when they die. And the artist himself, in writing the death of a character, that comes at a cost too. You feel bad about killing off a character that you had come to enjoy writing for. In terms of the etiquette of talking to people about death, I think you got to give people a 24-hour period. I think before you start mouthing off in the office about a death on Game of Thrones or in Scandal, give them 24 hours. Some people probably DVR'd it; they couldn't watch it that night. Give them 24 hours, and then I think even for the next week or so. You know, tell people, hey, I'm going to talk about this before you blurt it out, just so you don't, like, earn any enemies at the office. And definitely, for 24 hours, do not tweet about it or Facebook it in a way that has the revelation in the head. That's just not fair, because people will be scanning their Twitter feeds, their Facebook feeds, and see the revelation, and then against their will, they would have found out what happened and not be able to sort of be in on the surprise themselves.
Well, Christopher, it's been a lot of fun. Thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Ryder on Facebook gets the last word on this one, by the way. Everyone knows how Romeo and Juliet ends. It doesn't stop them from being moved by the play. Well, thanks to Christopher John Farley, editor for Wall Street Journal's Life and Culture blog, talking about death and spoilers on TV programs like The Game of Thrones.